Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 242. It's Monday, January 15th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I'm recording this on MLK Day, and as Martin Luther King Jr. warned us, of the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism. I just wanted to note how that aligns very much with public health interests. The scientific foundation of public health is epidemiology, and the philosophical foundation is social justice. And as Martin Luther King also stated, a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So let's get started with looking at one more layer in the horrors and misery that's occurring in Gaza right now. This from NPR. Another layer of misery. Women in Gaza struggle to find menstrual pads and running water. As the war between Hamas and Israel continues, Palestinian women and girls are often unable to find needed menstrual products and even running water and toilets. The UN estimates that some 700,000 women and girls in Gaza experience menstrual cycles but don't have adequate access now to basic hygiene products like pads, toilet paper, or even running water and toilets because of the war. These conditions put women and girls in Gaza at risk of reproductive and urinary tract infections, according to the UN. A spokesperson for UNICEF told NPR, "This situation is particularly challenging for women and adolescent girls who lack safe, private, and dignified places to manage menstrual hygiene. There are reports this is exacerbating mental health issues. It's messy, it's terrible, and nobody speaks about it. Openly talking about menstrual struggles remains taboo, even in wartime. That's partly a reflection of Gaza's traditional society, and because menstruation is a sensitive and private subject everywhere in the world. Israel's bombardment and evacuation orders have displaced around 2 million people, more than 85% of Gaza's population. As a result of this mass displacement, women also have to contend with a lack of privacy and little or no access to bathrooms. Much of Gaza has no access to running water, making showers a rare luxury. The water crisis is so severe that those in apartments, where extended families are sheltering together, can only flush the toilet when necessary, because every drop of water has to be carried up the stairs and rationed. Most Gazans, however, are living in overcrowded UN-run schools, where 400 people or more share a single bathroom. Others are living in tents and on the streets as Israeli evacuation orders push people further and further south. Women are waking up early and lining up at hospitals to shower before water runs out for the day. Others are lining up at hospitals just to use the bathroom." So just adding to another whole layer of misery and the countless indignities that war and conflicts bring us. And of course, the lack of clean water and toilets is both a cause for infectious disease, particularly diarrheal diseases. But of course, when you have diarrheal diseases, not having bathrooms is a problem for you as well as the people around you. Okay, well, next up, let's turn locally. I'm doing a series on the Lucas County Community Health Assessment, which was released in December. I started the first in series last episode and want to do a section on health status perceptions. So, and this is for adults in Lucas County. And this is where you ask adults about their health status, but this is a very valid measure and correlates very well with actual physical and mental health status. So here goes. 42% of Lucas County adults rated their health as excellent or very good. That, for comparison, we can look at the U.S. and Ohio, where over 50% of adults rate their health as excellent or very good. So, in general, we're doing worse, and this goes for both mental and physical health, which we'll get to. 1 in 6, or 16% of adults in Lucas County rated their health as fair or poor. 42% of adults reported that poor mental or physical health kept them from doing usual activities such as self-care, work, or recreation at least one day in the past month. More than a quarter, 28% of Lucas County adults rated their physical health as not good on 4 or more days in the previous month. Lucas County adults who were most likely to rate their physical health as not good on 4 or more days during the month were people who had annual household incomes under $25,000, that was 43% of people, compared to 28% overall, and those that were under age 30, at 32% versus 28% overall. And this is really kind of shocking when you think about it. We tend to think of youthful vigor and health, but actually adults under the age of 30 are more likely than adults over 30 to consider their health worse, having physical health that's not good on 4 or more days during the past month. Okay, and for mental health status, nearly 2/5, that's 39% of Lucas County adults, rated their mental health as not good on 4 or more days in the previous month. And that 39% compares to about 30% of those folks in Ohio and the U.S. So we're doing substantially worse there compared to Ohio and America as a whole. Lucas County adults were most likely to rate their mental health as not good on 4 or more days during the past month if they were under the age 30 at 65%. If they were black, 51%. If they were female, 47%. Had an annual household income under $25,000 at 46%, or Latino at 46%, compared to the overall of 39%. There you go. Then that's this week's installment of the Lucas County Community Health Assessment. There will be more to come. Stay tuned. Okay, well, next up, let's go to Ohio's story, a continuing story, this from The Hill. Ohio House votes to overturn governor's veto of transgender healthcare ban and athlete restrictions. The Ohio House voted last Wednesday to overturn Republican Governor Mike DeWine's veto of a bill that bans gender-affirming healthcare for transgender minors and prevents transgender women and girls from competing on female school sports teams. LGBTQ advocates, medical professionals, and families of transgender children have largely argued against the passage of House Bill 68. More than 600 people testified against the measure during public hearings last year. DeWine vetoed the bill on December 29th, telling reporters during a press conference that such a measure, if allowed to become law, would do more harm than good. "Ultimately, I believe this is about protecting human life," DeWine said. "Many parents have told me that their child would not have survived, would be dead today, if they had not received the treatment they received from one of Ohio's children's hospitals." DeWine on several occasions has declined to say whether he supports House Bill 68's restrictions on transgender student-athletes. In a 2021 statement, DeWine said he believes the issue is, quote, "best addressed outside of government." Gender-affirming health care for transgender minors and adults is considered safe, effective, and medically necessary by every major medical organization, although not every trans person chooses to medically transition or has access to care. The Ohio Senate, where Republicans also have a supermajority, is expected to vote on whether to override DeWine's veto when the upper chamber reconvenes on January 24th. If an override attempt is successful, Ohio will be the 23rd state to heavily restrict or ban gender-affirming health care for transgender minors, and the first to do so this year. It will join 23 other GOP-led states in prohibiting transgender athletes from participating in school sports teams consistent with their gender identity. Outside the legislature, access to gender-affirming health care for transgender minors and adults in Ohio will be restricted under administrative rules filed this month by the state health department. an executive order signed January 5th by DeWine prohibits gender-affirming surgeries for minors. Of course, a lot of the transition process doesn't involve surgeries, but DeWine banned that through an executive order. And of course, this legislation would formalize that as a law more so than just an executive order. Okay, well, next up, I want to turn to a couple big stories about what I believe to be one of the largest public health problems emerging in the coming generations, and that is exposure to plastics in many forms, whether it's water, food, soil, or our environment. This first up from CNN, plastic chemicals linked to $249 billion in U.S. healthcare costs in just 1 year, study finds. By contributing to the development of chronic diseases and death, a group of hormone-disruptive plastic chemicals, it is costing the U.S. healthcare system billions, over $249 billion in 2018 alone, a new study found. The real contribution of this work is helping the public understand how much of the human health threat of endocrine-disrupting chemicals is due to plastics, said lead author Dr. Leonardo Trasande, professor of pediatrics and population health at NYU Health in New York City. We're talking about cancer. We're talking about brain damage in young children. We're talking about obesity and diabetes, heart disease, and early deaths in adults, Trasande said. Right now, the United States is not considering the cost to its own population of industries which continue to produce and consume plastic in the U.S. While estimates of the health costs of plastics have been done in the past, the new study provides a better understanding of both potential exposure routes but also potential targets for solutions, said researcher Bethany Carney Almroth, professor of ecotoxicology and environmental science at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And since money talks, this could be a powerful tool in helping people, from consumers to policymakers, in understanding the importance of regulating these chemicals, said Carney Almroth. She was not involved in the research. Hopefully, the new study can initiate a societal discussion about the use of plastics and the health-related risks, said Jane Munkey, managing director and chief scientific officer at the Food Packaging Forum, a nonprofit foundation based in Zurich, focused on science communication and research. She, too, was not involved in this new study. These health costs are currently paid for by society and by individuals who suffer from the diseases, while the plastics manufacturers and businesses that use plastics for their products make handsome profits, Munkey said. This seems very unjust, and hopefully the study can initiate a discussion about true cost accounting, according to the polluter pays principle, she said. The new research analyzed the impact of four groups of chemicals used in the production of plastic products: flame retardants called polybrominated biphenyl ethers, or PBDE, phthalates, which are used to make plastic more durable, bisphenols such as BPA and BPS, used to create hard plastics and resins, and per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, also known as PFAS, or forever chemicals. There are over 16,000 chemicals used to make plastics or present in finished plastic products, as the new report will show that we are publishing in the next couple of months, Munkey said. If there were data available on all these 16,000 plastic chemicals, I'm convinced that the actual associated health costs would be far higher. Of those 16,000 chemicals, more than 3,000 are known to have hazardous properties, but close to 10,000 lack data. To my mind, this is absolutely insane. We don't know what's in these products, and we don't know who's being exposed to what. We don't know the implications of these exposures. The four chemicals measured in the new study, however, have been widely studied over years and decades, experts say. All are thought to interfere with the body's mechanism for hormone production, known as the endocrine system, and cause damage to developmental, reproductive, immune, and cognitive systems. The biggest impact of endocrine-disrupting chemicals is on children's brain development, because they disrupt thyroid hormones in pregnancy, which is crucial to that development. Flame retardants. Most of the cost burden in the report, $159 billion of the $249 billion, was some exposure to PBDE flame retardants, which scientists say can settle and remain for long periods in fat and other tissues in the body. The U.S. EPA is concerned that certain flame retardants are, quote, persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic to both humans and the environment. The critical endpoint of concern for human health is neurobehavioral effects, the agency said, because these chemicals are not chemically bound to plastics, foam, fabrics, or other products in which they're used, making them more likely to leach out of these products. Phthalates. This family of chemicals accounting for $67 billion of the healthcare costs in 2018, according to the study. Phthalates have been connected in studies with reproductive problems such as genital malformations and undescended testes in baby boys and lower sperm counts and testosterone levels in adult males. Other studies have linked phthalates to childhood obesity, asthma, cardiovascular issues, and cancer. Phthalates are found in hundreds of consumer products, including food storage containers, shampoo, makeup, perfume, and children's toys. The synthetic chemicals may contribute to some 91 to 107,000 premature deaths a year among people aged 55 to 64 in the U.S., according to an October 2021 study. Bisphenols. Exposure to bisphenols accounted for $1 billion of the 2018 healthcare costs, a study found. These chemicals are found in eyewear and water bottles, and they may coat some metal food cans, bottle tops, and water supply pipes. The chemical BPA has been linked to fetal abnormalities, low birth weight, and brain and behavior disorders in infants and children. In adults, BPA has been linked to diabetes, heart disease, cancer, obesity, and erectile dysfunction. Premature death is also associated with BPA exposure, a 2020 study found. People who have higher levels of bisphenol A in their urine were about 49% more likely to die during a 10-year period. Per- and fluoroalkyl substances. Exposure to PFAS chemicals was associated in the study with $22 billion in healthcare costs. Carpets, couches, nonstick cookware, stain-resistant clothes, cell phones, cosmetics, the lining of food wrappers. The list of popular products that contain PFAS are numerous and nearly impossible to avoid. In a 300-plus page report, the prestigious National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine found sufficient scientific evidence of an association between PFAS and an increased risk of adult kidney cancer and abnormally high cholesterol levels. Exposure to PFAS was also associated with decreased infant and fetal growth, as well as decreased antibody response to vaccines in both adults and children. The report recommended blood tests for people at high risk, such as firefighters, workers in fluorochemical manufacturing plants, and those who live near commercial airports, military bases, landfills, incinerators, wastewater treatment plants, and farms where contaminated sewage sludge is used. People in vulnerable life stages, such as during fetal development and pregnancy, early childhood, and old age, are at high risk, the report said. Depending on the levels found in blood, doctors should look for signs of testicular cancer and ulcerative colitis and test thyroid and kidney function at all wellness visits, the report said. In addition, doctors should prioritize screening for cholesterol, breast cancer, and hypertension during pregnancy. The authors of the new study chose to focus on the endocrine disrupting effects of the selected plastic chemicals. These are undoubtedly important, but I'm also very concerned about the presence of many known carcinogens that are used to make plastics and that leach from plastics, Monkey said. Our own work has shown that most of the plastic chemicals with hazard data available, only about 25% of the 16,000, are carcinogenic, mutagenic, or toxic for reproduction. Hopefully this study can be used as a stepping stone to also help develop cost estimates for the incidence of cancers. So just as a note and some more context, that $249 billion healthcare costs, that's about 6% of total U.S. healthcare expenditures just due to these relatively narrow plastic exposures, effect of petrochemicals on ourselves and the environment. That science is really in its infancy. And if we can well document 6% of total U.S. healthcare expenditures, it's likely to be a lot higher. And of course, as that fits in the total economy, that number is 1.22% of gross domestic product in the U.S. A little slice, a chunk, a plastic wrap, if you will, around the health of the U.S. economy. And interestingly, when you look at it from the business perspective and a public policy perspective, the amount of plastics produced in the United States is $97 billion in market cost. $97 billion. So the medical cost alone at $249 billion, that means that for every dollar that's spent on the market cost of plastics, we spend over 2.5 times that on healthcare costs. This is just another example of businesses being allowed to externalize costs like damage to human health or the environment that is not included in the price of their products. And when you're talking that the damage, the externalized costs, is far more than the price of the products as a whole, we can see that something needs to be done to help rein in and do some true cost accounting and have some public policy that can mitigate the health damages to both people and the environment. Okay, and in our second story on petrochemicals and our health, this from the 19th, chemicals found in everyday products may increase breast cancer risk. 90% of the chemicals identified as potential breast carcinogens in a new study are found in everyday products in homes and workplaces. More than 900 chemicals in widespread use could be increasing breast cancer risk, scientists reported in a peer-reviewed study published last Wednesday. Breast cancer is a leading cause of cancer death among women globally, and recently replaced lung cancer as the most commonly diagnosed form of the disease. Up to 80% of female breast cancers depend on estrogen and progesterone, and a growing body of research links increased activity of these hormones in breast cancer. The number of chemicals in U.S. commerce is enormous, yet few have been studied in women. Most evidence of cancer-causing agents in people comes from occupational studies in men. Yet health officials are seeing upticks in early-onset breast cancer in women that aren't explained by things like screening and early detection, noting that the list will help researchers focus their efforts on specific chemicals. Some of the most widely studied chemicals include classes of plastic additives called bisphenols and phthalates, parabens, and PFAS, known as forever chemicals. They're found in a dizzying array of products, including cash register receipts and canned food linings, the bisphenols. Soap, shampoo, hairspray, lubricating oils, and vinyl floorings, that is for phthalates, cosmetics, moisturizers and shaving creams, parabens, and fast food packaging, nonstick cookware, stain-resistant fabrics, and outdoor gear for PFAS. One thing regulators like the EPA could do is expand screening of chemicals that many people are exposed to. They could also recognize that chemicals that increase hormone levels are a cancer hazard. Many of the identified chemicals can both disrupt hormonal activity and damage DNA, a critical step on the road to cancer. Chemicals that cause mammary tumors in animal studies were roughly three times as likely to alter both DNA and hormones as those that don't, the researchers found. The combination of being able to increase hormones as well as being able to damage DNA was the biggest indicator that a chemical would be able to increase risk, adding that experimental evidence supports the finding. In fact, studies of BPA and phthalates show that the hormone-disrupting plastic additives also interact synergistically to increase the incidence of rodent mammary tumors beyond what either chemical does by itself. At relatively low concentrations, a chemical mixture has striking effects on normal cell function that are missed by evaluation of single components, researchers reported in a 2018 Toxicology Sciences study of BPA, parabens, and PFAS. Chemicals are typically tested for safety in isolation, even though no one is exposed to just one chemical at a time. Many of the chemicals on our list are already acting as co-exposures that we cannot avoid, adding that women of color face disproportionate risks from pollution and personal care products. Black women and other people of color often face more toxic exposures. For example, hair products black women tend to use have more toxic chemicals compared to the hair products white women use. On a typical day, a person might be exposed to parabens in shampoo and body lotion, formaldehyde in hair relaxer, PFAS in a pastry wrapper, phthalates in perfume, flame retardants in carpets and couches, and pesticides in food, along with any number of other pollutants in the air. If cooking with gas, one is likely to ingest high levels of benzene, a well-known carcinogen associated with oil and gas development and burning fossil fuels like natural gas, that's methane. A person's risk of developing cancer increases with age as the body's DNA protection machinery wears out. But in people under age 50, breast cancer in women is six times more common than any type of cancer in men. That suggests that some sort of environmental exposure is causing tumors to develop much earlier than expected. These exposures are likely to come in the form of any number of the currently used 40,000 plus chemicals, which are mostly made from petroleum. The EPA estimates about half of the estimated 86,000 known synthetic chemicals are actively used. One of the things that really struck me about this study was recognizing that there are tens of thousands of chemicals in current use in the United States, but only about 2,200, maybe 2,300, were even tested for their ability to increase estrogen or progesterone in the assays that we looked at. Even when chemicals are tested, they aren't screened for some traits expected to increase breast cancer risk, like promoting inflammation or activating progesterone. And some chemicals are allowed onto the market, including widely used pesticides like atrazine and malathion, despite evidence showing that they cause mammary tumors. It's mind-boggling to consider how little is known about the universe of chemicals people are exposed to. They've only screened so many chemicals, and only for the types of activity they screen for. Then you think about all the activities they don't have screens for, and all the chemicals that haven't been tested at all. Even so, one thing is clear. The chemicals identified in this analysis act in ways that are known to increase breast cancer risk in animals. Even if there hasn't been enough time to really demonstrate the link in humans, we know enough about how these chemicals can increase risk that we can start treating them as hazards. And this is a good time to remind people of a very important principle in public health and other areas of risk assessment, the precautionary principle. Meaning that if you're going to introduce something new into the environment or in society, it should be shown as safe, not just waiting for it to do damage and then try to do cleanup later. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, let's switch gears and talk about an interesting story about rising health problems with increased substance use in the last couple decades. And this one's talking about heart disease deaths. Now, this is linking substance use with heart disease, but it's not talking about tobacco, which, of course, is a widely used substance, nicotine being the substance of use or abuse that's addictive. But this study isn't talking about the heart disease deaths and smoking, because largely because of the carbon monoxide, well, and other damage, but the thing from moments after you smoke, getting carbon monoxide is greatly increases the risk of a heart attack or and sudden death. That's not actually considered here. Of course, like with smoking, we don't often think of heart disease as being the major factor, but more people die of heart disease from smoking, for instance, than cancer. And here, when we think about substance use deaths, we think of it in terms of overdoses, but here we're seeing a continuous and steady rise in heart disease deaths. This from the American Heart Association. U.S. heart disease deaths linked with substance use rose 4% per year between 1999 and 2019. Alcohol was a factor in 65% of the deaths from cardiovascular disease, followed by opioids, cocaine, and other illicit drugs, finds a new study in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Despite drops in overall cardiovascular disease deaths from 1999 to 2019, cardiovascular disease deaths in which substance use was cited as a contributing factor increased an average of 4% per year, with a death rate accelerating to 6.2% from between the years 2012 to 2019. Prominent increases in cardiovascular deaths associated with substance use were most notable among women, American Indian or Alaskan individuals, younger individuals, rural area residents, and users of cannabis and psychostimulants. Heart disease continues to be the leading cause of death in the United States, and substance use is one contributor to that. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to an area of healthcare where we're doing a little bit of a regulatory catch-up. This from the Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Deep flaws in FDA oversight of medical devices and patient harm exposed in lawsuits and records. Over the past year, Kaiser Family Foundation Health News has investigated medical device malfunctioning, including artificial knees manufactured by a Gainesville, Florida company that remained on the market for more than 15 years, despite packaging issues that the company said could have caused more than 140,000 of the implants to wear out prematurely. Metal hip implants that snapped in two inside patients who said in lawsuits that they required urgent surgery. Last resort heart pumps that FDA records state may have caused or contributed to thousands of patient deaths. and even a dental device used on patients without FDA review that lawsuits alleges caused catastrophic harm to teeth and jawbones. CBS News co-reported and aired TV stories about the hip and dental devices. The investigation has found that most medical devices, including many implants, are now cleared for sale by the FDA without tests for safety or effectiveness. Instead, manufacturers must simply show that they have, quote, substantial equivalence to a product already on the marketplace, an approval process some experts view as vastly overused and fraught with risks. Patients believe they are getting an implant that's been proven safe, said Joshua Sharlin, a former FDA official who is now a consultant and expert witness in drug and medical device regulation. No, it hasn't, Sharlin said. And once these devices reach the marketplace, the FDA struggles to track malfunctions, including deaths and injuries, while injured patients face legal barriers trying to hold manufacturers accountable for product defects. The 1976 federal law that mandated safety testing for high-risk medical devices also created a far easier and less costly pathway to the marketplace. This process, known as a 510K clearance, requires manufacturers to show a new device they plan to sell as, quote, having substantial equivalence to one already on the market, even if the prior product has been recalled. Critics have worried for years that the 510K approval scenario is too industry-friendly to protect patients from harm. In July 2010, an Institute of Medicine report concluded that 510K was not intended to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of medical devices, and a move away from the 510 clearance process should occur as soon as reasonably possible. More than a decade later, that hasn't happened. Even amid mounting controversy over the clearance of hundreds of devices that employ artificial intelligence, the FDA now clears about 3,000 low to moderate risk devices every year through 510K review, which costs the device makers a standard FDA fee of about $22,000. That compares to about 30 approvals a year through the stricter pre-marketing requirements, which cost nearly $500,000 per device, according to FDA data. Diana Zuckerman, president of the National Center for Health Research, said even many doctors don't realize devices cleared for sale typically have not undergone clinical trials to establish their safety. Doctors are shocked to learn this, she said. Patients aren't going to know it when their doctors don't. We can't get detailed data, said Sandra Rothenberg, a researcher at the Rochester Institute of Technology. It's very hard for researchers to determine the basis on which substantial equivalence is being made and to analyze if there are problems. Rothenberg cited the history of metal-on-metal artificial hip implants, which under 510K spawned many new brands, along with a disastrous toll of patient injuries. The implants could release metal particles that damage bone and led to premature removal and replacement, a painful operation. Just four of these hip devices have now been the target of more than 25,000 lawsuits seeking damages, court records show. In early 2016, the FDA issued an order requiring safety testing before approving new metal-on-metal hip devices. The FDA operates a massive database called MAUDE to alert regulators and the public to emerging device dangers. The FDA requires manufacturers to advise the agency when they learn their device may have caused or contributed to a death or serious injury, or malfunctioned in a way that might recur and cause harm. These reports must be submitted within 30 days unless a special exemption is granted. But FDA officials acknowledge that many serious adverse events go unreported. Just how many is anybody's guess. Since 2010, the FDA has cited companies more than 5,000 times for not handling, reviewing, or investigating complaints properly, or for not reporting adverse events on time. For instance, the FDA cited an Ohio company that made electric beds and other devices more than 15 times for failing to properly scrutinize complaints or report adverse events, including the death of a patient who allegedly became trapped between a bed rail and a mattress, agency records show. In about 10% of reports, more than a year or two elapsed from when a death or serious injury occurred and when the FDA received the reports. That works out to nearly 60,000 delayed reports a year. Experts and lawmakers say the FDA needs to find a way to detect safety problems quicker. Senator Chuck Grassley and Elizabeth Warren have tried for years to persuade the agency to add unique device identifiers to Medicare payment claim forms to help track products that fail. In an email statement to Kaiser Family Health News, Grassley called that a common sense step we can take upfront to mitigate risk, improve certainty, and save money later. The FDA said it is working to, quote, strike the right balance between assuring safety and fostering device innovation and patient access. Yet it noted, additional resources are required to establish a fully functioning active surveillance system for medical devices. For now, injured patients suing device companies often cite the volume of adverse events reported to the MAUD system, or FDA citations for failing to report them, to bolster claims that the company knew about product malfunctions but failed to correct them. In one case, a New York man is suing manufacturer Boston Scientific, claiming injuries from a device called the AMS-800, which is used to treat stress urinary incontinence. Though Boston Scientific said on its website that 200,000 men have been treated successfully, the lawsuit argues complaints piled up in MAUD year after year and no action was taken by the company or by regulators. The number of complaints filed soared from 6 in 2016 to over 2,700 in 2019, according to the suit. By far, the largest category involved incontinence, the condition the device was supposed to fix, according to the suit. Yeah, great when you get a product that produces what it's supposed to fix. Yikes. Boston Scientific did not respond to a request for comment. The company has filed a motion to dismiss the case, which is pending. Some countries don't trust the device industry to play such a key role in oversight. Smart. Australia and about a dozen other nations maintain registries that measure the performance of medical devices against competitors, with an eye towards not paying for care for a substandard device. That's not likely to happen in the United States, where no device or drug manufacturer must demonstrate its new product is better than what's already for sale. Product liability lawsuits in the U.S. often cite troubling findings from overseas. For instance, registries in Australia and other countries pinpointed durability problems with the OptiTrack knee implants manufactured by that Florida device company years before a major recall. The company has declined comment. Registries have gained some traction in America, but so far they typically have been controlled and sometimes funded by industry and medical specialty groups that share their findings only with their doctors. One private registry managed by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, called Intermax, tracks death and injury rates at 180 hospitals in the United States certified to implant a mechanical heart pump known as an LVAD. Some patients might find that information helpful, but it's not available to them. While the FDA clears thousands of devices for use based on the substantial equivalence premise, manufacturers often tout new and exciting features in their advertising and other marketing, said Alexander Everhart, a researcher at the Washington State School of Medicine in St. Louis. These marketing campaigns have long been controversial, especially when they rely partly on whining and dining surgeons and other medical professionals to gain new business, or when surgeons have financial ties to manufacturers whose products they use. Orthopedic device manufacturers have funneled billions of dollars to surgeons, including fees for consulting, doing medical research, or royalties for their role in fine-tuning surgical tools and techniques, even promoting their products to their peers. Marketing campaigns directed at prospective patients may receive little scrutiny. The FDA has, quote, limited resources to actively monitor the volume of direct-to-consumer advertising, according to the Government Accountability Office report issued in September. From 2018 to 2022, the FDA took 255 enforcement actions involving advertising claims made for devices, according to the Government Accounting Office report. So we have a long ways to go, and perhaps something we can learn from some other nations who do a better job and don't rely on industries to self-regulate. Okay, well, next up, let's switch gears and go to a global story about fungal diseases. This from Medical Express. New estimate doubles the likely deaths from fungal disease globally. The annual total deaths from fungal disease worldwide has risen to 3.75 million, double the previous estimate, according to a new study. In a paper titled Global Incidence and Mortality of Severe Fungal Disease, published in The Lancet Infectious Diseases, David Denning, a professor of infectious disease at the University of Manchester, also calculates an annual total of about 6.5 million acute cases using data from over 80 countries. Though fungal disease has multiple causes, the updated mortality figures nevertheless dwarf deaths from other single pathogens, killing six times more people than malaria and almost three times as many as tuberculosis. The work is the result of a collaboration of over 300 professionals across the world who contributed to publish estimates for their country and individual fungal diseases. Previous estimates were imprecise, argues Professor Denning, as many fungal diseases exacerbate an existing order, itself often severe, such as leukemia or AIDS. However, according to the study, of the deaths linked to fungal disease, around 68%, or over 2.5 million, were likely to have been directly caused by it. Around 1.2 million deaths, or about a third, had other underlying disease, with fungal disease contributing. Around a third of the 3.23 million chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, deaths worldwide are linked to infection with the fungus Aspergillus, finds Professor Denning. So that's an interesting one. COPD, you wouldn't think that, but it looks like about a third of them worldwide are fungal infections rather than, say, bacterial. Though pulmonary tuberculosis was classified as the main cause of death in 1.2 million people in 2019, as many as 340,000, or 28% of those cases, could actually be fungal disease deaths, he estimates. And of course, fungal diseases is something that plays in with increasing changes from climate instability, and is also an issue when we're talking about antimicrobial resistance. Okay, well, let's end the regular reporting with some good news on global health front. This from Reuters. The World Health Organization declares Cape Verde free of malaria. The World Health Organization has declared Cape Verde free of malaria, hailing it as a significant milestone in the fight against the disease. Cape Verde, an archipelago of 10 islands in the Central Atlantic Ocean, has faced severe epidemics in densely populated areas before it implemented targeted interventions. It gives us hope that with existing tools, as well as new ones, including vaccines, we can dare to dream of a malaria-free world, said the WHO Director General. The WHO said that in the heavily affected African region, Cape Verde had become the third country after Mauritius and Algeria to eliminate the mosquito-borne disease. It joins the ranks of 43 countries and one territory certified by the WHO. This certification has the potential to attract more visitors and boost socioeconomic activities in the country, where tourism accounts for approximately a quarter of the GDP. The WHO certification is granted when a country has demonstrated no locally transmitted cases of malaria in at least the last 3 years. Congratulations, Cape Verde. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. Okay, 36 bonus articles this week, so let's get rolling. Article 1, want to get more healthcare bills passed? Fix the filibuster. So as we're moving into political season, this is a good example of the filibuster is kind of an anti-democratic thing, thwarting the will of the people. A lot of things that are very popular cannot be passed because of the filibuster. It's not just healthcare bills, but this article talks specifically about healthcare bills being held up. Bonus article 2, millions of U.S. women, children, risk hunger without more WIC funding. So this is a supplemental food program for pregnant and postpartum women and children under the age of 5, and it has received large bipartisan support for decades and is one of the most cost-effective programs in government. But it looks like with all the wrangling with budgets that millions of women and children may not be able to get WIC funding that they're eligible for. Bonus article 3, Congress nears deal to partially restore Biden's expanded child tax credit at cost of expanding corporate tax breaks. So the good news is that this child tax credit, which when it was fully implemented, cut child poverty in half, will be partially restored, but that's only at the cost of expanding corporate tax breaks. So we'll have to see whether that's worth it or not, or whether that actually happens. Meanwhile, back to the red states, bonus article 4, Republican governors in 15 states reject summer food money for 8 million kids. So summer feeding programs are not going to happen in 15 states because they're simply turning down the money. Bonus article 5, to get fresh vegetables to people who need them, the city of Boulder puts its soda tax to work. So we have federal things, we have state things, and we have local or city things. And this is a good example of where a city, which has a soda tax, is using some of that money to get fresh vegetables to people who need them by providing vouchers to low-income folks, which people love. They learned that it isn't because people don't know to eat vegetables. It's because they're expensive and poor people don't buy them for that reason. Bonus Article 6 from another nation. Colombia is taxing ultra-processed foods. So this is starting out at 10% and moving up to 25% in a few years. This is a great way to raise revenue, hopefully, for health programs and other social goods, but also to cut down on the amount of ultra-processed foods bought and consumed. Bonus Article 7. New data shows just how many Ohioans traveled out of state to obtain an abortion in 2022 after Roe fell. So this is a good retrospective and has a lot of data about that year. Of course, Ohioans passed a constitutional amendment guaranteeing reproductive rights. So that is changing, thank goodness. But it's a good read if you're interested in reproductive rights in Ohio. Bonus Article 8. Applying global lessons to protect abortion access in the United States, such as destigmatizing and decriminalizing abortion, framing abortion as a human right, and reproductive rights as part of health equality and freedom of conscience. Bonus Article 9, how megacities around the world are tackling air pollution. One I found interesting here was waste management, because in a lot of poor cities around the world, if you have trash sitting around, people will burn it, which is a terrible source of air pollution. And for those of you in the first world, bonus Article 10, air pollution is ruining your skin. Wildfire smoke and exhaust fumes are triggering spikes in eczema and other skin conditions. So our skin is our first line of defense immunologically and to protect our body just as a physical barrier, but it's exposed to the same kind of toxins that we eat and breathe. So air pollution is ruining your skin. Bonus Article 11, how America's animal-based diet is feeding the groundwater crisis. So livestock and dairy, particularly beef, uses a lot of water in its production. And these also happen to be in areas where groundwater might be particularly endangered. So a problem. Bonus Article 12. It lives in geologic time. Nuclear contamination and health risks remain throughout Colorado. So this is just an example of the fact that these health risks often established from mining or weapons production from decades ago are lingering generations later and will be around essentially forever in geologic time, something that we usually don't consider in our planning as a society. Bonus Article 13, bottled water contains thousands of nanoplastics so small that they can invade the body's cell. So this was a really popular article since people drink a lot of bottled water. The trick here is that nanoplastics are way smaller than microplastics, so they can actually directly go into the body's cell and cause problems. So microplastics will eventually turn into nanoplastics. And of course, they have different biological properties as well, besides just being small enough to get directly into the cells. Bonus Article 14 is a COVID-19 research roundup. So if you want the latest on what's happening with COVID-19, one of the more significant ones going on is Bonus Article 15. America is having a senior moment on vaccines as millions of people most at risk of dying aren't getting COVID shots. So, you know, a lot of people say, hey, I don't want that extra shot, even though they're effective across the board at substantially reducing your risk of serious disease and infection for a while. A lot of elderly and people at particularly high risk are just bypassing getting the vaccines. A sad loss. Bonus Article 16, skipping school, America's hidden education crisis. Absenteeism nearly doubled since the pandemic, with state and federal governments largely advocating any role in getting kids back into the classroom. Some schools have turned to private companies for a reimagined version of the truant officer. So this is a story of privatization. It's a story of kids' truancy, skipping school, or absenteeism, which is worsened by the pandemic, but continues as a problem. And the fact that school districts and local and federal state governments have not done a good job of really addressing this hidden problem. Bonus Article 17. Survey finds many U.S. healthcare workers face harassment and burnout. So this was also increasing prior to the pandemic, but that accelerated it. And just another roundup of all the issues that healthcare workers face. Related to that, bonus Article 18, docs' vacation habits may be fueling burnout. So doctors are one of the highest paid job categories in the U.S., but they don't have a lot of control necessarily over their work time and either may not take vacations or take work on vacations, which can degrade the quality of vacations quite a bit. Bonus Article 19, a culture of silence persists in medicine despite the Me Too movement. So sexism in medicine, surprise, surprise, reported on that plenty of times before. And an interesting story, bonus Article 20, about the interface of an individual who's researching structural racism, a personal story that we can learn from. As she drives research on structural racism in healthcare, Rachel Hardiman faces a painful reckoning. She happens to be at the University of Minnesota, and Minnesota is considered a progressive state, but has one of the largest racial ethnic health disparities in the country. Bonus Article 21, millions of dollars of pharma money went to the diagnostic manual authors. So this is another conflict of interest story. And the next one is as well. Bonus Article 22, U.S. diet panel adds another researcher with alcohol industry ties. After dropping two Harvard experts who had received industry support, the National Academies turned to a colleague with a similar background. So I reported on this originally, and here we are. You can get caught, get press on it, and they still just want to do the same thing. Yeah, it's a long, protracted fight. Bonus Article 23. Americans overwhelmingly favor healthcare price transparency, another version of transparency that we need to have an honest accounting of business practices in this country. Of course, you know, if you were buying a car and didn't know what the price is, you think that'd be a little bit crazy. But of course, healthcare often costs more than a car. Bonus Article 24, private equity firms are gnawing away at the U.S. healthcare system. So just another example of where when profit is made the center of what you do, it gnaws away at actually producing health. Bonus Article 25, the climate costs of war and militaries can no longer be ignored. More than 5% of global emissions are linked to conflict or militaries. So when you're comparing bread and butter issues versus arms, this is one. Bonus Article 26, new research explores a restorative climate path for the Earth. Existing green growth policies are leading nowhere fast, so scientists say it's worth exploring alternatives like degrowth to stay within planetary boundaries. So we really need a sea change, and this is a good read to get a handle on that. Bonus Article 27, quest for personalized medicine hits a snag. Current models have limited effectiveness to predict treatments. So this is the idea of doing checking your blood and running a whole bunch of tests on it and find out just individually, you know, your differences compared to populations as a whole and customize your treatments. Well, most of the models that personalize this are based on small studies and small data models. And this is a real warning for AI coming down the pike too, because it finds out within those models the idiosyncratic nature of a particular data set is actually what AI and these algorithms are picking on, not actually an underlying thing. So when you try it in another population, it just simply doesn't work. Bonus Article 28, landmark study finds prescribing opioids dramatically reduce deaths and overdoses for drug users who typically rely on unreliable and dangerous sources. So just giving drug users a prescription for the drug that they use, like opioids, massively cuts down on overdoses, mostly because the sources that people get these drugs from are unreliable and unsafe. You never know whether you're going to get a big dose of fentanyl. I'll take you down. Bonus article 29. Gender dysphoria diagnoses are rising nationwide. That's probably not a surprise, although this story has a link to a really good report that will give you an update on a lot of trans issues and gender dysphoria in particular. Bonus article 30. Baths, books, and sex. Survey explores Americans' regular bedtime routine. So if you're curious about what your fellow Americans do at bedtime and what their routines for getting to sleep, this is a great story. Bonus article 31. PTSD, depression, and anxiety nearly doubles in Israel after aftermath of Hamas attack. Doubling PTSD, depression, anxiety is a huge thing. Of course, I'd like to also see the study. This is in Israel after the Hamas attack. I'd like to see a similar study in Gaza after the genocide that's happening in Gaza right now. Bonus article 32, sludge videos, that is videos with multiple clips playing simultaneously, are taking over TikTok and people's minds. Yeah, it's not good for the brain. And in a related story, bonus article 33, toddler screen time tied to abnormal sensory outcomes. Yep, don't expose your kids to screens if you can avoid it. Bonus article 34, how living like a hunter-gatherer could improve your health. So civilization is often overrated, and how simplifying your life could help. Good overview of that. 35, researchers report dramatic decline in cigarette use among U.S. teens over three decades. Some good news there, although vaping is way up. Bonus article 36. American Red Cross issues urgent plea for blood donations as shortage is the worst in 20 years. If you'd like to donate, you can call 1-800-RED-CROSS. If giving blood is what you want to do. You can view these and all the other articles I've reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.